accession number 28898, rule 13.
West Charles with rule 13.
So I started climbing up on a single engine because I wanted to gain height to bail out. I had an ejection seat, Ken didn't, but he had a rails, he could come on the rails, go backwards, open the door and fall out backwards through it, and he had nothing to impede him, he was straight down, whereas I had to get over the tailplane, so I had an ejector seat. But I said, Ken, when I say so, get ready to bail out. I said, get into the bailout position. He said, right. So I said, get yourself sitting. I told him I'm in the bailout position. He said, right, I'm in the bailout position now. I said, right, when I say so, we've got to bail out, but we'll just go on and see how this engine goes. So he saw sparks and things were still coming out of it, different flames and bits of flame and sparks. I thought, well, if that catches the wing tanks, we're going to blow up. So I said to Ken, okay, I don't know where we are, but we've got to get out. So get ready to bail out. He said, I can't do it. I said, Ken, get ready to bail out. He said, I can't do it. I said, you've got to bail out. You don't leave a fellow. You don't just eject and leave someone in the aircraft. Captain of the aircraft is the last one out always. And I said, look, Ken, you've got to bail out or I'm going to go. He said, no, I can't do it. I kept plus climbing. And the sparks were getting a few less from the engine. I said, you bugger. Right, anyway, I stayed with the aircraft and climbed on the single engine up until we broke cloud. And I called Mayday. I called Mayday straight away, and several bases came back and said, what's wrong? And I said, I'm on fire, and I've sick cloud, and I've got to land somewhere. And one or two people suggested I bailed out. I said, that's not an option, I'm afraid. I didn't want to say that Ken wouldn't do it. And anyway, I leveled out, started having called up my base down at Larbrook, and they got me, it was long range, they called me, they said, hey, we're here, we're on standby for any emergency, steer us at a certain course and you'll get back here. And I went back on a single engine, and somehow we got back, and landed on, had to do a descent through cloud on a single engine again, and a long GCA talk down, so when you get on a glide path, and they talk you down a bit, left a bit, right a bit, and you juggle on and single engine, and you don't make too many mistakes. And eventually, I broke down. Thank God, there were the runway lights. It was pitch black night. And I put it down, and my heart gave a pounding. I went to the end of the runway. I said, "Right, Ken, get out fast." So he didn't get out then. I had to get after him because he was blocking the doorway that he would have fallen out through. So I fastened all my belts and straps and my arms and knees and things, and climbed out and got down after him, and we just ran away from the aircraft. And there was a ticking, clunking noise coming from there. It started to cool down from the starboard engine. So that was that. So anyway, what had actually happened was that whether it was through a long distance of gliding down, but when I opened the power again to level off at 1,000 feet going in towards Heligoland, that's when this big flame came out of the starboard engine. And what had happened was the forward bearing was not getting oil or something. It was bronze bearing, fossil bronze bearing or copper bronze bearing, and it was going around dry. The sparks from that were flashing up into the burning cannons and lighting up the fuel in one steady stream instead of providing, getting a proper air fuel mixture. And this great flame came out of the back, and that's what caused it. That's what they found. It had burned out the engine, but it fortunately stayed there. I'd hit the carbon dioxide button at the right time. But it was bloody scary. I said to Ken, look, Ken, next time this happens, I'm going to go. I'm not having this happen again. Got out on tenders the whole time. I thought, Christ, this is it. First of all, I thought, I hope they'd climb up on one engine all the way there with this going on. And I was tired, and I'd been flying our instruments most of the flight. And that was a bit nerve-wracking, but in fact the whole lab's manoeuvre was a bit, because you were totally on instruments, you couldn't see any horizon, it was nothing, just pitch black, you had this manoeuvre. But fortunately the war didn't break out, and managed to get through the end of that and came back.
How long were you with the squadrons?
I was out there about 2.5 years. So I came back and...
So what year were you looking back coming back? Was it roughly 50?
59. But I got back, did a bit of time at Bawtry on a ground job. Bawtry, which is a number 3 group bomber commander. And then I was asked to go and teach bomber command, camera force, the lab's manoeuvre, how to do it. So I set up a little place down at Coleshill, where I've been during the war, and I was based down there, and bomber command pilots used to come through, and I used to teach them how to do labs in the T4, the training version of the camera. And rather funny there, because I was the bomber command camera instrument flight training instructor, tester. I had to sign everybody so they could fly an instrument to the maximum degree, you know, limitation is maximum limitation. And we had a very nice Air Commodore, one of the men at group headquarters, 3 group headquarters of Bawtry. Very nice character, and he used to fly the odd camera occasionally, but he used to normally fly a Meteor when he wanted to fly, but he flew very rarely because he was a SATA, senior air staff officer in headquarters. Anyway, he rang me one day and said, Max, my instrument ratings ran out. It had to be renewed every year. He said, get a camera organised and, you know, give me a going over. So I got one organised at the local airfield, Litchfield, where it was. And I said, OK, for 11 o'clock on Friday morning. So he said, yes, I'll be there. So I got in, and he strapped him in and everything, got him in, took off. And it's quite a thing. You have to take up on instruments. You have to do a certain number of circles going up that way, then going up that way, gaining so much height per circle, all on instruments, at a certain speed. All the instruments had to be in the right place at the same time, on instruments the whole way. And then, and he had what device did we have? He had some screen or something that prevented him seeing out. So I could see out, but he couldn't see out. And then he'd go up and then do various manoeuvres at altitude. And then the most difficult one was getting out. I'd say, right, now I've got to put the aircraft into a position that's going to get you totally... what's the word?
Disorientated.
And then you've got to get out of it. Okay, and get a straight and level on instruments. So I pulled the aircraft up, went over and did a roll and a tight turn, and I said, okay, you've got the aircraft now, get it out of this. Well, I think they're on a single engine, on a limited panel. A single engine, limited panel, and strange position. Well, he got out of that all right. You know, he lost a lot of height, and took quite a while getting out of it, but we got out of it. But everything he did, he was a little bit beyond the limits. The climb up, he was beyond the limits. I said, you've 10 knots over the limit, sir. He said, oh, okay, now you've got the turn, you said a 30-degree turn, you're doing a 35-degree turn. Oh, I have to get back to 30-degree turn. And he kept doing this all the way up, all the way down. And anyway, he came in, he did a single-engine blind landing with no instrument, with just some basic instruments. That's the last thing he did, and that's the toughest of all things to do. And he managed to get through that, but he was outside the limit. And when we climbed out, he said, OK, Max, we'll just sign the documents and send them out to my office, won't you? I said, I'm sorry, sir, but you failed. He said, what do you mean I failed? I thought, you've failed the test. You're outside the limits most of the time. He said, I've never failed an instrument flying test in my life. I've always had an instrument flying card. I said, well, I'm sorry, sir, I can't sign it. And I was squabbling there. I said, I cannot sign it. I wouldn't be doing my job. He said, well, I want it. But he signed it. He said, I might have to fly instruments sometime. I said, well, sir, you'll have to get some practice in, really. I cannot, you were outside your limits. Oh, he blasted away and like mad. And I often thought afterwards, he may have been testing me. If I'd said, oh, I'll sign it, he may have thought, this chap's going to be the instrument flying test instructor for all the bomber command, and he's going to let them go like that. Don't think he's in it doing the right job. So I stuck to my guns and said, no, I'm not signing it. Sorry, you're outside. And I think he appreciated it. He said, well, okay, Max, if you say so, I'll get some more training in. I left it at that. But that was quite interesting, because I was the Bomber Command flying training examiner, that's the word, flying training examiner. And anyway, I was there, bullshit, I was a ground job, but I used to fly fairly regularly, because they had the airfield nearby, and they'd go and borrow an aircraft and do some flying.
Did you enjoy that as a role?
Well, yes, because I was introducing the labs role to Bomber Command. And I had to keep submitting papers to the Air Officer Commanding, saying, you know, we're going to do it this way, sir, and what if we do it this way and this way, and, you know, the new thing.
Did you introduce new techniques or think of new ways of doing it at all?
Well, I introduced I suppose I was, to a certain extent, in Germany, was partly involved in the routine of labs bombing, and how to do it, and what speed we should fly in at, and all the rest of it. And so, yes, we were the first squadron. I was a senior member of the squadron. I wasn't a flight commander of the first squadron. I was a senior member of the squadron. I had more experience flying, and particularly instrument flying, and weapons generally. So, yes, I suppose I had a hand in introducing labs to the Royal Air Force.
And was it a constant... Were you constantly tweaking it and working it a little bit better?
Yes, we were always wondering whether we could just make it either easy to do or more accurate. We're constantly sort of working on it until we thought, well, we can't get any more accurate than this. This is about it.
Was it an effective way of delivering the weapon?
Well, we never had to, fortunately, we never had to prove that. I personally never thought we'd get away from the bomb blasts. I thought we'd be disorientated by the blast and we'd never get away. And anyway, we couldn't have got back. We'd have had to have crashed down somewhere in Germany.
So what was your next role after?
Well, I did laboratory. Then somebody from P2 rang me up and said, we've got a job we'd like to offer you, Max, if you'd like to take it. I said, what's that? He said, assistant air attaché in Poland. Well, this is the dark days of the war, of the Cold War. I said, what the hell does that mean? He said, well, we'll give you a briefing if you like, but it means you have to take your wife, because she had a lot of hosting of parties, and it's a party ceremonial, partly social, and partly a job of work to do, which we'll tell you about if you're prepared to accept the job. I said, well, I better go home and see her. I came home to see Jeannie that lunchtime. I said, we've been posted to Poland, Jeannie. She said, we haven't got any air base in Poland. It's miles behind the Iron Curtain. I said, no, we're not going to the air base. We're going to the embassy. And I'm just an air attaché there. She said, God, I'm not going. I'm just not going. I don't have a social life. I'm kidding me. I'm going to throw all those parties and things. So I finally talked into it eventually. And we went there. And that was, that was perhaps the most exciting part of 2.5 years of the whole of my RAF career.
Which years were those?
That was... Kennedy was killed whilst I was out. It was 1960, I think, to about 62 and a half. I can't remember the exact dates, but to about that. I know Kennedy was killed whilst we were there. I remember coming back from it.
Was he killed 63?
Hmm?
Was he killed 63?
Was he?
Yeah.
Oh, well, it was 61 to 63 then. 63 and a half, something like that. Yes, it must have been, because I got back from Germany in 59, 60, went to Bortry for a while, and got there. Yes, it would be about 60, perhaps 62, got out there.
And what did your role in...
My role in Poland was to assess the potential of the Polish Air Forces on Polish soil, the effectiveness of their radars and where they were situated, and also the Russian, because the Russians had two air forces, our total air force on Russian soil. The same thing with them, their effectiveness, their potential capabilities, and their radar structures, and where they were on their effectiveness. And of course that meant going out dressed in Polish clothes, unmarked car, and unfortunately, I signed the Official Secrets Act, So I don't know what I'm talking about. But it was dicey. I just meant climbing onto barbed wire and having guns stuck in your back and that sort of thing. And taking photographs. And I reckon that by the time I'd finished, I'd altered several maps of their airfields, because they'd gotten on the Ministry of Defence's idea where the runways went was wrong. So by clambering under the barbed wire with the covers and measuring the end of the runway from the map, they go to the other end and measuring it right. I'd reconfigured them to where they actually lay, the runways. But it was, all their airfields were in deep pine forests, which took a lot of getting into. And of course, we had to get away from the secret police, because there was two Mercedes crammed full of secret police outside the house the whole time. I had a little daughter and Jeannie down there. Wherever I went, they followed me. If Jean went shopping, they followed her into the shop behind her. So they constantly followed. And getting away on these trips, it was a hell of a job. You had to get rid of the secret police, so you couldn't do it. Eventually, they intercepted you because they had radio contacts with each other. They could intercept you at a certain time. They said, "Oh, God, bloody black Mercedes bearing up behind." And they were a bit faster than the cars we used. And their Mercedes 200s, they could go for a whole day from early dawn till late at night without refueling, because the whole of the back of their thing was one big tank of petrol. And they could sleep in their cars, they could pull it leave and pull the seats back, they could cook in their cars and cook it came out. So they didn't have to leave their cars at all. And they were staying the whole time. So as we tried to take off whilst they were perhaps reloading the fuel, we'd get away again. And we used to make for pipe tracks in forests and go down these bumpy tracks. But it was always away for about 3 days' time, probably twice a month. And we'd cover 1,500 miles or so in each 3 day trip. And we'd just go and check on there. We'd probably get a message, a signal from the Ministry of Defence saying there's a Russian Bar 4 landed at a certain airfield. It's got some peculiar radar under its starboard wing. I wanted a close-up photograph of that to get it to us quickly. Well, probably that's not very well saying that, but you've got to get into the airfield, you've got to get under the barbed wire into the airfield, take a long-range photo, picture of it. And then get back out again into the car away without anybody seeing it. It all sounded very easy, but it was plenty difficult. You know, it's a question of seeing the sentries going by the outside with their dogs, lying low, and as soon as they felt you could go dashing along, getting under the wire, and then there'd be another wire inside of that one. But once you're inside, you're away from these fellas, then you get another next one, you just keep going through this pine forest until eventually you break out to the airfield. And of course you had to keep yourself hidden, or it was very difficult. And then you'd do a quick count of all the aircraft from there, and what marks they were, what marks of MiG or whatever they were. Whether they had any transport aircraft or any helicopters, where the control tower was, where any radars were, everything you could get. And then you do a landscape, a photograph, what do you call it? And they're all running into each other.
A panorama.
Panorama of the whole airfield. And then the hell out of it.
Were you provided with cameras for all this?
Oh, yeah. We had all sorts of cameras. We had training before we went out in London of taking photographs in difficult places. I mean, one of my tasks was to get inside an American B-29 base, not B-29.
B-52.
Yes, B-52 base, and take the numbers of all the aircraft tails of all the aircraft on there. Well, American bases were very heavily defended also. But we were told if we were caught by the Americans that to ring this number, and that was the American intelligence chief's number saying who we were. But I managed to do that and get away with it. And then take those pictures of various people, a little Minox camera down here. He's got right close there, and click on. And that sort of thing, you know, it's like James Bond sort of stuff, really.
When you were doing the airfield thing, if you'd have been caught, what would have been the consequences?
Well, when I called on the ambassador, Sir George Clinton, it was the quintessential sort of picture of an English aristocrat, tall, gaunt-featured, white-haired, wore very dark black glasses because he was half-blind, spoke absolutely fluently, spoke Polish more fluently than the Poles did, all the different dialects in Poland. He knew everything about Poland. And he was the, what you would imagine, if you had to draw an ambassador, you'd draw this sort of character. He was absolutely aristocratic, 6'6", and gaunt sort of chap. I went to see him. When I arrived, of course, I went to see him, make my number, because I was on the CD, the diplomatic corps. I didn't know, I had a CD badge on the car, and part of the diplomatic corps. And I see him and said, you know, this is making my number. He said, sit down, Charles. He said, I know what you're doing here. I know what your job is. He said, my job is to try and ease the tensions between the East and the West and form some sort of relationship with the Polish government. Your job is to destroy that relationship, which you are doing. Every time you go out, you destroy it. He said, I don't want to know, don't tell me what you do. I don't want to know what you do. Now, I'll tell you one thing. If you're ever caught out there by the secret police, I shall disown you. I won't know who you are. If they ring up to check on you, which couldn't carry any. Well, we did carry some identification. I mean, what it was now, it wasn't worth very much if fed into their hands. But we were stopped two or three times, but we managed to talk our way out of it. We thought there was a Russian nuclear dump right in the midst of pine forest in the centre of Poland, a big Russian nuclear bomb dump. So I was out with an American this time. We always went out with somebody, some other person. And we went out in his, he was driving the car. It was his car. And we'd got our story. We suddenly came up to this area and we saw these concrete roads going into this forest. Well, we don't have concrete roads leading into a forest anyway. What was the point of that? So we knew there was something down there. So we started to ease down this concrete road. And it was fairly newly laid. It was substantial concrete, went down it, trickled down, trickled into the edge of the wood, it went on into the wood, went round and round and round, and off, probably went a mile into the wood. And suddenly, from a bunch of trees either side of us, leapt some Russian soldiers, all armed with Kalashnikovs and things. And, halt, stop, because it was, you know, what was a car doing here in the midst of our big army dump? So we stopped fairly rapidly, and I thought, Christ, this is it. And but we, see, we had a story made up beforehand. There was a little village that we knew was on the other side of the forest. Now, although we learned a bit of rudimentary Polish before we went out there, the Americans learned an awful lot, and they could speak much more fluent Polish than I could. So this American colonel sitting alongside me, when he stopped, he said, perhaps you can tell me in Polish. I want to see an aunt of mine who lives in a village which said we'd look her up and go and see her when we could. And of course, there were Polish soldiers there, were young 18-year-old conscripts. They didn't know whether they were coming or going. You know, they were nervous as kittens. And they didn't know what to do with a strange car. It wasn't it had Polish number plates. You know, I forget what it was now. An American car of some sort. But it was a bit old and battered looking, and we were dressed like Polish peasants, Polish people. And of course, we had underneath the seat, we had long-range cameras and short-range cameras and all the gear. And so he said, "Will you identify yourself, sir?" Not the window. Identification. So we both agreed just to put the window down just a little bit and show him this thing through the window. So we showed him this, I forget what his tab was. Oh, yes, it was a saying that we're attached to the embassy, but not in what form. So it showed this to him, and he said, please give it to me. I said, no, you look at it through the window. I said, no, I want it. No. Look through the window. Okay, back, front. Okay, that's me. So they had a telephone on a tree, on these wired-up things. So I went up, run this up. And this is, I looked around, there wasn't an officer amongst them, some senior mercy, but we knew about Russian uniforms, what badges of rank. I think the senior chap was a sort of corporal. Or we never thought anybody had ever come down there. He just rang up. And in the suite, officer here incoming, he can't be coming here. So, oh Christ, here we go. So eventually this officer appeared in his little jeep and walked across, and first of all he asked with these guards, he looked at the car, and he asked at the guard, and looked at the car, he came across and he started talking to him and said the same thing. We want to see our auntie, she lives in this little thing over here, you see. Well, they had no, I don't suppose they had their minds on spies or people like that. They just thought we were a Polish couple who got lost somehow. But we were certainly forbidden territory to be in. Because it had, at the beginning of the concrete road, it had the "no, can't come in" sign. Did you see the sign? Well, I didn't know, I'm just saying it in Polish, talking in Polish to this chap. He said, did you see the sign? I said, no, what sign? Didn't see a sign. I thought this was a shortcut to get to this place. No, it is not. It is not a shortcut to get to this place. Well, we'd better back out. No, you stay there. And stay there. I must talk. Yattering together, this crowd of about 12 or 20, or pointing at the car and yattering away. And eventually he said, the officer said, I want to see your identity, sir. The colonel said, not yours, the colonel. So the colonel leant across me. I put the window down a bit too much, holding his card there, and before I knew it, I had a Kalashnikov in my ribs for a soldier who was standing behind this officer, alongside this officer. And he pulled the thing which ejects the card. I knew it was loaded. It was already finger on the trigger. It would, you know, it had been had 30 shells right through me. And so, but what we were, you see, we were much more intelligent than they were, and we could psychologically baffle them, which we did. And we really made them think, we made them wonder what to do. Because we said, we'll report you to the police if you don't register to stay around. We were perfectly entitled to come. Poland is a free country. Wasn't it? We want to see our friend. And so they kept yattering together. So I said, look, to old George. I said, George, when they start yattering, I said, we'd backed into the side. Backed in, you see, out of the way, out of the road, across the road. We're backed in, so we're facing the road like that. Here's a car. We'd come in this way. So I said, look, George, they're getting a bit slap happy now. They're not taking my say. They don't know what to do. They're yattering amongst themselves. So when I say go, turn the engine on and just go up this road, hell for leather. That's all we can do. We can't do anything else. So they were very preoccupied by the Russians and just talking to each other. They got cigarettes out. I don't know whether they were waiting for somebody else to come down or not. But this chap had removed his gun from my back and had stepped back from the car for a couple of yards. And I just slowly slid the window, electric window. And I said, okay, George, now. Back wheel skidding up the road. I'm ducked down, sort of, expecting a hail of bullets, but nothing came. We shot back up this road and away again. But for three quarters of an hour, it was a very scary time. Because we just didn't know what was going to react, how they were going to react. We couldn't get help from anybody. But this happened to on a Polish airfield once. Just getting it under the wire, and two Polish pilots came by. Well, now, the Polish pilots, a lot of them were trained in England. In fact, we asked Colonel Hankiewicz, who was the chap who was supposed to be stopping us from going where we wanted to go. He was a liaison officer. And when we used to meet him at the ceremonial dues, just I used to get back from a day out in the country doing it. I would come back and he always looked grim faced because we'd outwitted their secret police cars, you see. And we'd get back in and we'd say, oh, you have a glorious country here, Colonel, because he speaks English. Very nice scenery, sort of driving his back. Oh, yes, well. And why am I mentioning him?
Because you said they've been mainly trained in
sorry?
The UK. You said Polish pilots have been trained in the UK, but once you got under the wire...
Oh, yes. Just a bit of an aside. We got him and said, look, we have plenty of ex-Polish RAF pilots. Can we invite them to the embassy for some drinks? He said, I think this probably can be arranged. Yes, we probably can do this. And he did do. And they came down. And they were fantastic. We said, what are you doing here? They said, oh, what are we doing here? We can't get out of it. said, here we are. They have DSCs, DSOs. He said, we can't get out of it. We're in the Polish Air Force now. We were put in prison as soon as we got back here. It took us out when they realised who we were. We're now in the Polish Air Force and we're trapped here. We can't do anything about it. But they said, can you get us out? We said, no, we can't do anything about that. So the Polish Air Force had a sort of sprinkling of these ex-RAF people. So they had a bit of a... They were very pro-Western as well. They weren't happy with this communist setup.